Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Today I'm joined by book reviewer and Monocle's Toronto correspondent Chris Frey to sift through a few recent literary releases. On our book list today, we have Satin Island, an ambitious new novel from Tom McCarthy, a posthumous collection of essays by historian Tony Judt entitled When Facts Change, and The Ward, a non-fiction compilation of writing about Toronto's original immigrant ghetto that was wiped out last century. All that and more to come here on The Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show, Chris. Let's begin with an intriguing new novel by Tom McCarthy, Satin Island. But before we talk about the book, Chris, let's talk a little bit about the author. He's a controversial character of sorts. He's a very literary writer, and he takes his literature very seriously. Is he sometimes a little po-faced, or is he a witty writer? How would you characterize him?
I think I'd give him the benefit of the doubt and call him witty. I mean, and that especially comes across in Satin Island. And as much as he is literary, he's also a bit of a conceptual artist. And I mean, he identifies himself as an artist. And I think when he first started publishing his writing, he experienced some frustrations, you know, getting it out with publishers. And he almost directed a bit of his creativity into conceptual art projects. And he started, I think it's called, what is it, the Necronautical Society, something like that, sort of a bit of a riff on the surrealists. So, and then that sense of a conceptual artist does come across in Satin Island as well. I found Satin Island funny, but I think it's a book, as we'll discuss, that's probably not to all tastes.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the book then, because he's been compared sometimes favorably, sometimes unfavorably to everyone from, you know, Burroughs to Kafka to J.G. Ballard. And I think that some of those influences are identifiable, perhaps, on the pages of Satin Island.
Yeah, and I think even more so people like Thomas Pynchon and Don DeLillo, you know, these, I guess, postmodern fabulous type writers. And at a glance, Satin Island might appear his most approachable book, almost slight and somewhat breezy as it clocks in at 176 pages, and it consists, you know, as his books typically often do, these short numbered sections, many of them no more than a paragraph long. But, you know, typical McCarthy, the novel is anything but slight, despite its size. Rather, it's bracingly cerebral and very insightful. Even if it's packed with more ideas than plot, it's very frequently confounding and even sometimes tedious, all of which I think is perhaps purposeful on McCarthy's part. It's easier to say what Satin Island is about than what happens, because very little would seem to happen. Our first-person narrator, identified only by the initial you, is an ethnographer who works for some enigmatic international consultancy. From what is, you know, little is said directly about the company's business, we can assume it's some sort of supercharged branding agency that advises cities, governments, and corporations how to tell their story. And when the novel opens, the company has won an important new contract. This project, we're promised, will have an impact on our daily life, even though none of us will quite notice it, and little else is said about this mysterious project. And not that this important project drives the plot in any way. What we get instead is, this anthropologist come narrator obsessively observing and scrutinizing the world around him. He deconstructs meanings, invents alternate ones, seeking the underlying patterns and connections in contemporary life. Most of the book is taken up with him disappearing into these little wormholes of association. He riffs on subjects as diverse as, you know, the ventilation system in his company's office building. He riffs on oil spills and fatal parachuting accidents. You know, and occasionally he discusses his own work, which would seem to involve identifying and dissecting memes or behavioral trends. But little else would seem to materially happen.
And I guess some of those themes you mentioned there, Chris, are things that people who are familiar with McCarthy's work will already be familiar with. As you mentioned, looking for sort of discrete or implicit connections between things, notions of repetition. And these are actually some of the kind of themes that he's looked at in his previous writing as well.
Yeah, and in here, you know, there's the one plot device that pops up about halfway through. I mean, a few characters pop up, so we'll say there's very little characterization. There's a friend with cancer. a girlfriend and the narrator's guru-like boss, but they seem to amount to little more than items of study for the narrator. So he's eventually tasked with writing this, you know, capital letters great report, the first and last word on our age, as his boss calls it, a theory of everything. But and here, notably, the narrator founders, McCarthy almost mimics Jeff Dyer a bit as the protagonist maps out the most grandiose plans for his book, A Theory of Everything, and then quickly falls into a routine of procrastination and distractedness. And that's here where I find a lot of great humor. You know, in some senses, it's a satire of corporate civilization, and maybe even a satire, too, on the search for meaning and grand narratives. And that's something, too, that in its, you know, fractured or fragmented way, certainly fits in with the rest of McCarthy's writing.
Chris, just finally on this, I know McCarthy often rails against sort of what he terms, you know, intellectual illiteracy, and he talks about a failure to engage with avant-garde writing. And he's actually said to ignore avant-garde writing is the equivalent of ignoring Darwin, and it makes you a creationist or whatever the equivalent literary that figure that would be. Do you sort of quite like, you know, the presence of people like McCarthy, mischief makers, if you will, in the literary world? Do we actually we need people like him, don't we?
Oh, certainly we need provocateurs. And I think he recently wrote an essay, it was perhaps for the London Review of Books, where he took, you know, the sort of trend, or, I mean, memoir writing has never really been a trend. It's always been with us. And having worked for a book publisher in the past, I know how much of an appetite they and readers have for memoirs. But for, I guess it was recently that McCarthy took on the frenzy over Knausgård and what that sort of memoir writing represents in the literature and the culture. And we certainly need provocateurs like McCarthy. I mean, I go back and forth on Staten Island. I mean, you know, from one page to the next, I find my loving it and, you know, alternately finding it a bit tedious. But I can't fathom a world or a literature without, you know, the likes of McCarthy.
Well, you can judge for yourselves. Staten Island by Tom McCarthy is out now, published by Jonathan Cape. Let's move on, Chris, and talk about When the Facts Change, Essays 95 to 2010 by Tony Judd, edited by Jennifer Hommons. These are some of the most prominent and controversial essays that maybe didn't fit in with previous collections. Give us a bit of an overview. I don't know, put this book and this author's work, I guess, in some kind of context for us.
Well, first of all, Judd died in 2010 at the age of only 62 from Lou Gehrig's disease. And all these essays, as you mentioned, you know, didn't fit quite anywhere else and were mostly published towards the end of his life. You know, the book does reflect the rather vast and eclectic comfort zone that Judd occupied, covering topics as disparate as Europe before and after the Cold War, Israeli politics, the Holocaust, America as a superpower post 9/11, globalization, rising income disparity, social democracy. The book also contains some very, I'd say, moving tributes to some of Judd's favorite writers and thinkers, including his hero Albert Camus. And there's also two very, you know, I'd say also very moving and thought-provoking essays on the social merits of rail travel that stick out somewhat from the other essays, but introduce a bit of a personal aspect of Judd. He's always fallen more to the left end of the spectrum, certainly, but at the same time, you know, he's made his life's work of not falling prey to dogma. And I think that's where his, you know, hero Camus comes in. In Camus, Judd admired not just his sympathy with the oppressed as a matter of principle, but the rejection of dogma and the willingness to change one's position along with the facts. And it, of course, it's the quality that gives this collection its name, a quote commonly attributed to John Maynard Keynes, "When the facts change, I change my mind." And, you know, that's a sentiment that's almost lost in today's polarized political culture, at least in North America, where it sounds almost alien.
Well, yeah, let's pick up on that point then, Chris, about the polarized North American political environment and how, you know, Tony Judd has been looked at before, and maybe how the essays in this book might change that opinion, because there's still a lot about, you know, the state of Israel, its relationship with the wider region. He was unpopular from, you know, certain people on the American right because of positions that he took. Do you think that, you know, these works now a little later will sort of maybe prompt people to reappraise their views in America and Canada as well?
Yeah, well, I guess there's two answers to that. I mean, broadly, what's most impressive about the collection, or most of the essays here, is how pertinent they still feel today, as though Jut was anticipating some of the central preoccupations of our age, even when he was writing as far back as the late 1890s. I think this is especially true when he's talking about the sustainability of the European project, or the European Union in the face of rising disparities, resurgent nationalisms, or let's say unwanted immigration, and also the consequences of neoliberal economics and its dismantling of social safety nets. But when you mention Israel, I think one of the highlights here is his controversial 2003 essay, Israel, the Alternative, which is the one essay that probably put him on the outs with a lot of people, and in which he argues that the state of Israel has become, in his own words, a dysfunctional anachronism. And he proposed a one-state solution to end the Israel-Palestine conflict, one in which Arabs and Jews enjoyed fully equal status. At the time, Jut was, as you mentioned, vilified, denounced, and even by some of his friends on the left. But in a subsequent article that's also published in this collection, Jut admit that he was in part being deliberately provocative, that he was addressing specifically American Jews with his proposal, wanting to confront them with what the death of the two-state solution would entail for Israel's future. So full credit to Jut, you know, prescience for all the attacks he endured. The talk about a one-state solution is back in circulation, even if, again, it's back in circulation for somewhat provocative reasons, to again remind American Jews or Israel and its supporters what the failure of the two-state solution might mean.
Chris, just one final question on this. This collection is edited by a fellow historian and, of course, his widow, Jennifer Holmes. What did you think that you know, lends, I don't know, almost an additional sort of authority to a collection, or it prompts you to look at things in a different way when it's being compiled by somebody whose understanding and sort of intimacy with the subject is different from your run-of-the-mill editor, if you like?
Yeah, I mean, the introduction she writes is extremely affecting. Again, we get a bit of personal insight into Jut, into his process, how he approached his essays. And I think it's a great way to start off the book, because what becomes most palpable from it all is how much we still need a historian of Jut's compassion, of his intellect and voice. And not to mention his popular reach, because let's remember, among, you know, historians, I mean, he was published by a major house, and his books were, you know, relatively well read. And as he writes in one of the essays he includes here, the recent past is the hardest to know and understand. And that may be so, but of course it hardly stops, you know, the daily pundits from telling us with full authority, you know, how to interpret today's news. Jut might be, you know, has been dead for 5 years. And on the one hand, given his influence and foresight, it feels as though he's barely gone. On the other, you know, given the noise we're so often left with, his absence is all the more felt.
That's When the Facts Change, Essays 1995 to 2010 by Tony Jut, which is out now, published by William Heinemann. Chris, let's end the show by talking about something, well, from your neck of the woods. Tell us a little bit more about The Ward. We're delving into some Torontonian history, aren't we?
Yeah, The Ward is a collection of nonfiction from a variety of contributors, and it tells the story of Toronto's first immigrant neighborhood, which was dubbed The Ward, from the 1840s until World War II. The Ward was where waves of new arrivals first landed in Toronto. You had Jewish, Italian, African-American, many of them, you know, escaped slaves, Chinese and Irish, all of them crammed into this impoverished, rough-and-tumble precinct that was eventually raised in the 1960s to make way for a new city hall and some hospitals, which was itself a moment that both signified and coincided with the birth of modern Toronto. It's really a fascinating part of the city's history, all the more so for how The Ward prefigured the multicultural or polyglot city Toronto, you know, has become today. And yet, as much as city leaders today boast of our multiculturalism, that about half the population is born abroad, Toronto has actually done very little to acknowledge the neighborhood's role in its history or tell the stories of those who lived within it. I was born and grew up here, and I thought I knew the history reasonably well, but only became aware of The Ward and its significance a few years ago. So, you know, fortunately, this book, which is from a small local press, Coach House Books, does a wonderful job of filling in the blanks and gaps of Toronto's official history. In otherwise staid Protestant Toronto, The Ward could be a lively, chaotic, you know, dangerous, a very thrilling place, home to derelict 19th century row houses, brothels, there were bootleggers, you know, the gambling parlors, burlesque and vaudeville theaters, you know, which of course made it, as one of the articles here is called, Where the Rich Went for Vice. Notably, it was also a petri dish where various social reforms are first tested before being tried elsewhere in the country.
Well, I just wondered about that. You mentioned these sort of the gaps in history there, Chris. And that's always really interesting when you look at cities that have changed fast, and particularly when you look at neighbourhoods that have been redeveloped often over and over again. You mentioned this book helps to kind of fill in the gaps, but does it, I guess, also acknowledge the fact that with all of the change and with the appetite for renewal there's often been in this, in these neighbourhoods in particular, that there'll perhaps be some things we'll maybe never quite know that was lost in the various changes over the through the generations?
Yeah, I mean, there's a tremendous loss. We tend to celebrate, and I know I have in the past, you know, celebrated Toronto's new City Hall designed by Villiers Ravel, which was, you know, created in the 1960s. And, you know, it's this modernist sculptural building that in some sense symbolizes, you know, the city's aspirations and its openness and its democratic character. But it's very, you know, it's ironic to understand, you know, what was obliterated to give its place. In a sense, the ward, both the book and the neighborhood, tells the origin story of the Toronto we know today. And not just because of that multicultural character, but also for how it shows the forces of gentrification and what they often erase. And that's a process of gentrification that's remaking large sections of the city today. You know, Toronto, I think, is probably the fastest growing city in North America. You have 100,000 new residents. As it's often been said, the downtown and even the suburbs are studded with construction cranes. And so that process is happening today, maybe not at the same scale from what happened in the ward, but it's taking place in pockets around the city.
And that's The Ward, which is out now, published by Coach House Books. And that brings us to the end of today's programme. Chris Frey, thanks very much for joining us. As always, great to speak with you. And this has been the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Thanks to our producer, Holly Fisher, and researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for this week's film review. Until then, it's goodbye from me and the team, and thanks very much for listening.